The Business of Marketing podcast is brought to you by Demand Exchange. Demand Exchange provides the technology, content, and expertise to identify and acquire your next ideal customer. Season 3, Episode 6 features Lottie Jones, Chief Commercial Officer of the News Movement, in conversation with Justin Cook, Chairman of Demand Exchange.
So I am delighted to be joined here on the Business of Marketing podcast live at Advertising Week New York by Lottie Jones from the News Movement. Lottie, hi. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you for having me.
So first of all, give us a kind of a snapshot on the News Movement. What is it all about?
Well, we're a social first news company. We have two newsrooms for our predominant news brand, TNM. They're based across London and New York. We also oversee The Recount, which is a political feed out here in the US with a month to go before the election. It's obviously hotting up quite a lot. But we were founded, I suppose, out of the frustration with the proliferation of misinformation online, and as a result of that, wanted to fuse the rigor and I suppose the editorial craft of journalism with the dynamism and the exciting, frankly, nature of social media and bring news to a new generation. Originally, our focus has always been on younger people, Gen Z particularly. But as time has gone on, it's fair to say in a world where everyone overhears everything, we have fans and followers from all different age groups and indeed way beyond just the UK and the US as well.
I can imagine. Okay, I kind of get it at a high level. Can you bring it to life a little bit for me?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll start with TNM because we started that from scratch. And as such, we've been through a lot of trial and error. Our newsrooms do skew towards Gen Z. So we hired a lot of journalists straight out of journalism school. Partly, I think, to be able to hire them when the craft of journalism was still very much instilled in them. However, also, they bring with them the perspective of the audience that we're trying to reach as well.
Yeah, great.
So there's an element of talking to the audience through themselves. And we cover everything from breaking news, Trump gets shot, through to world politics, geopolitics, right through to, demure trending online, you name it, we'll cover it. We do have a number of verticals specializing in themes such as sex and relationships that are obviously particularly pertinent to the audience. And as time has gone on, our audience has skewed slightly female leaning. And so we have a thriving newsroom. Constantly, they'll come in every morning. They'll pitch ideas to the editor. They're schooled in research. They have to ensure that everything is fact-checked. There has to be a sort of impartiality that's deployed as part of our storytelling techniques. However, to the naked eye, what you receive or what you do is go on a bit of a journey with the journalists. We always quote, actually, when Russia invaded Ukraine, we did a minute-long explainer that started with where Ukraine was on the map. So we don't assume any prior knowledge and take people on a journey through the eyes of the audience that we're trying to reach.
And how is your content consumed? Where is it consumed?
You name it. Every single social media platform. So everything from X to Instagram. Obviously, TikTok is huge for us. And YouTube. But it's worth saying, just because we produce something for TikTok doesn't mean we just recycle it and shove it up on Instagram and vice versa. Particularly, I'd say YouTube for us is where we do quite a lot of long-form documentaries. We've recently released one about the Trank problem in Philly, which has been particularly, that's taken us months of preparation to bring to the fore. But that wouldn't necessarily work on a platform like Instagram, where things need to be snappy and delivered in a quick, creative way.
And you've obviously sort of the kind of precursors to you, I'm thinking, I mean, in the UK, and again, please don't judge me on my poor kind of examples here, but the Tab, I'm thinking kind of BuzzFeed, I'm thinking Vice, kind of like how this movement itself has evolved, right, massively. Mm-hmm. Give me a sense of kind of the differentiators and the kind of your view on how this world of news, you know, has evolved, and in the context of those other sightings, and even some of the Guardians and the BBCs and CNN type. It'd be just really good to kind of understand your position, I suppose, in the market.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good word for it, because it has evolved a lot. Mm. And I think back to the early days of Vice when, you know, it was delightfully feral, that actually the weirder and more wonderful and kind of experiential the story, the better. But that was largely, and I'm sure RIP Vice wouldn't mind me saying this, it was inventing a lot of news as well as covering and legitimizing news. And what we tend to do is reflect back or hold a mirror up to the world that our audience is navigating in the early, mid, late 20s. There is a bit of weird and wonderful in there, don't get me wrong. However, I think there is a seriousness or a sort of very grounded nature to our storytelling currently that is probably more akin to some of your traditional media mastheads you mentioned there. And the vernacular of news storytelling, as you rightly say, is changing online. When you go to the social media feeds of the likes of WSJ, WashPo, and in the UK, the likes of The Guardian, there are more journalists and people from the newsroom telling stories online, rather than just your static tile swipe through, here's a news story. And I think that is probably more where we live. And dare I say it, you know, we were one of the first people to do it. So bringing with us that journalistic rigors at the core of what we do.
And you yourself, your background, kind of how did you, give me kind of a career, how did you end up kind of where you are now?
It definitely wasn't linear. I grew up on agency side. Mm-hmm. I started out working in the third sector and then worked in corporate comms for many years before starting my own consumer agency, which I led and sold to an agency called Teneo out here in the US. It was a corporate consultancy that advised C-suites about big, meaty reputation turnarounds. And I think that's what I'm really passionate about, which is building a business in the news movement that works with businesses who are undergoing transformation, scrutiny, reputation, and want to change perceptions and tell their story in interesting ways. So I suppose what I've done is transpose that agency model to the media world. Lazy logic would suggest that in setting up a news brand, you create subscriptions, cross your fingers and hope for the best. However, obviously, young people and the way that social media is built aren't necessarily going to part with money in the same way. So for us, it's much more about bringing creative brand storytelling to young people in a way that doesn't mean that they're just being sold at, but you're entering into a conversation with them. So I'll give you an example. We worked with TELUS, which is the biggest mobile phone operator in Canada. And they're quite famous out there for a notion of social capitalism, which is essentially an old money, giving back to the communities you operate in. We work with a Canadian creator out there to be able to go to those community initiatives and really bring to life the stories in ways that didn't feel patronizing. It didn't feel like a dad at the disco, and invited a community of understanding around what it is they do that was totally separate from selling network. And those are the kind of stories that I'm fascinated about telling and building for brands.
So effectively, and forgive me on the terminology, but so you're not the business model is not subscription. It's not, you wouldn't call it yourself ad funded. would you classify, how would you describe your business model, I suppose, is my question.
Brand partnerships. Yeah, in old money terms, as I say, we're not yet ad funded. Mm-hmm. We are quite openly experimenting with the notion mm-hmm. of micropayments as an alternative to subs. And our B2C product come 2025 is going to be a massive focus for us. Particularly exciting now we're starting to hit the audience figures that can really substantiate it. It means that we can be particularly creative with how we go out there and do it. But to date, obviously, it's been, as I say, holding the hands of brands and businesses that want to tell those powerful yep. stories online. And working with a lot of the platforms as well. One of our big projects last year was with Snap, mm-hmm. Working with creators to train them how to tell news stories on the platform and kind of equip them with that journalistic training in our newsroom and then going out there and doing their thing in a way that was quite unboundaried. And
fascinating. And I think that's, I love this idea of the fact that Snap has a very different kind of set of superpowers and dynamics mm-hmm. than TikTok and, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. every other channel. And everyone's in a slightly different nuanced audiences and so forth. And so you can kind of really play the medium, right? It's mm-hmm. it's a real art form. And let's talk about that, because I think mm-hmm. I'd love to kind of get your POV on the differences, right?
In terms, yeah.
And then how you draw out their strengths.
Yes. Actually, Snap's a good example of a platform where we really encourage our journalists to do the talking. We have an excellent journalist in The Recount, which is our political feed over here, called Grace Weinstein, who has a huge following on Snap. And a lot of that is just, you know, we cannot at all take credit for it. It's her doing her thing and being allowed to be as creative and herself as she can and should be. A lot of that's behind the scenes footage of her as she's out at, you know, the DNC or the RNC over the summer. Her meeting fans of Trump and having conversations with them, outtakes, you name it. But there is an immediacy to the dialogue that she has with her fans and followers that makes a huge difference to how she's able to show up for news storytelling as well. Again, we can't necessarily take credit as having crafted that with her, but I think what we have done is allow our journalists the freedom to express themselves personally in domains like that. However, when and if those individuals show up under the auspices of The Recount online, they will work closely with Jessica Cohen, our editor, to craft a story, how it comes across, ensuring particularly with politics, the non-partisan, balanced nature of that story. It's heavily researched, it's fact-checked, it's even sort of, I don't know, has to pass the sniff test mm-hmm. for bias, which can be incredibly subtle, particularly in the UK versus the US on political storytelling. So despite it looking and feeling incredibly spontaneous when you go to our feeds, there is a hell of a lot of stage management that goes into that prior to, the creativity coming into play.
I find that fascinating. It's like just from the outside hearing you sort of break it down in that sense. Describe the kind of the roles of the newsroom in the news movement. Like, give me the roles. Like, how's it orged up?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because obviously, as I say, I come from an agency background where everyone kind of knows everyone's business. However, and again, many of your listeners will already know this, but I think living through it and in it, it's a very, you can know something, but then feeling it is incredibly different. The division between church and state, between an editorial newsroom and the commercial side of the business exists for a reason, and that is obviously to prevent partiality. However, what I think is clear to see is that a lot of editorial newsrooms then don't necessarily understand how businesses run. And in a small, intimate team, it's very hard to create separation. In fact, it's so hard, it feels unnatural. And I think what we are doing, and I dare say are succeeding in achieving, is a newsroom that can comfortably overhear what we're doing on the commercial side without feeling biased, and a commercial operation that is sensitive to the craft of journalism. And what this means is those frustrations don't necessarily exist like they do in traditional media, and our journalists and commercial team can work not necessarily always on blended teams, but they can work together as colleagues and not worry about that tension. And I suppose similarly, when I think about how we've set up the commercial team, what I'm really passionate about is that my sales team and my marketing team don't stay so fixed in their lanes that they can't cross-pollinate. And particularly, in this day and age, mm-hmm. learn from each mm-hmm. other. You know, a bit like myself, just because you start at sales doesn't mean you're not going to end up a CMO and vice versa from
in fact,
a CRO.
The closer you are actually, the better, right?
Correct. Today. Completely. So even, here we are at Advertising Week and, my marketing team are here with my sales team and, we're all in it together. We hosted a great talk here today and that was produced by both of them. And it's not to say that targets don't exist for each of them, but they're able to speak each other's language. And I think that's paramount.
So I've got sales, I've got marketing, I've got journalists. Obviously, I've got editors. What else is in the team?
We have account handlers as well, and that's I suppose this is where you start to see the traditional agency language creeping in. That when you sell in inverted commas a good idea to a brand, stewarding through them through that process, particularly with social media, which can feel like a very uncontrolled environment, is so important to the success of a campaign. Explaining and unpacking certain, even pieces of jargon or how it all works to a PR client, somebody who works in the brand team or somebody that works in a media buying agency, that's all going to look like a very different conversation. So our account handlers are really the stars of the show in terms of being at the front line, making sure that things get delivered to time. If something's not working out for a certain reason, explaining why. But I'd say it's more akin to a comms agency setup than it is a media buying one, where when you've sold, you sail it down the river, give some data back, and everyone's happy. It's slightly more hand-holding exercise.
Fascinating. Going back to the point you made around sourcing journalists just as they're coming out, what are the traits and skills and behaviours that you look for in it? What makes a great journalist for you and or for anyone today?
I can give my perspective.
Yeah.
I defer to Becca Hudson, who's our editor-in-chief at CNM, and Jessica Cohen at The Recount for what exactly they look for. But in terms of what I observe, I think, a natural hunger for culture is so important that it's not enough to treat it like a science. There is an art to it as well, which is following the right people, being a sort of news-hungry but culturally savvy. I'd say that our journalists are as sort of book smart as they are street smart. They're all incredibly bright and engaging, but also you want to go for a beer down the pub with them. And I think that dichotomy is quite rare. So being able to identify it is really important. I also think that, in this day and age, particularly when you've trained for a job and you're on the brink of starting, not just doing a job, but a proper career. There's an earnestness and a seriousness with which you need to make decisions and handle yourself. And I think that we have done a good job in creating a culture which respects that and fosters it, however, have a ton of fun as well. Mm-hmm. And there is a fluidity and a freedom and a transparency to the way that we communicate business functions or editorial decisions that I think is quite empowering and adult. They're not infantilized.
And then in terms of the more sort of, transactional kind of skills to do the job, like what do they need to have kind of in the toolbox?
Well, I think it's attention to detail. Mm-hmm. And again, this is where I start to get slightly hazy because I'm definitely not on the inside of the editorial sort of process. But I think the thing that I'm certainly impressed by, as I say, from a distance is the detailed amount of fact-checking and rigour. And as I say, even a raised eyebrow can imply a partisan bit of bias to the story that you're talking about. So how to maintain, you know, that sort of what I would think of as, you know, a newsreader mentality, but the face and the energy of a creator. And those two things, they're so difficult to strike a balance with. So I think somebody being able to capture that, and there is an element of performance to it, whether you call it that in journalism or not, I defer to somebody else on, but an element of being able to, yeah, inspire interest by bringing people with you. It's not easy.
And are they working with a team of folks who are then helping ensure that the kind of the format kind of, you know, is kind of, you know, in keeping with, you know, the medium and so forth, or are they,
yes,
are they almost a sort of a kind of multi-discipline kind of multifunctional in sort of
Yes and no. They do oversee their own work end to end, which is something we also do on the brand side. So when we work with specific creators that we'll bring in for brand projects, not necessarily on the editorial side, we will work with them to ensure that the production standards, and I think what you're getting at as well is the imagination, really, and creativity is there for us to be able to not just make it like a boring old newscast. You know, gone are the days where you expect that BBC newscaster sort of reading the news on social. It obviously has to be lively and different. And on the brand side, certainly, we have a number of checks and balances and, you know, for want of a better word, grey hair, seasoned marketers who have been in the game long enough to know what a client will expect without neutering the kind of dynamism and the energy that comes with a generation who's grown up on social, which I can't claim to be.
And you mentioned sort of you've reached a kind of stage and size and scale kind of in order to be able to kind of, you know, change the kind of conversation slightly. Give me a sense of the breadth and depth of kind of what, where have you got to now as a business in terms of size and scale?
Yeah, we're reaching around 500 million a month.
Wow.
That's across all different platforms. I feel like that often those telephone numbers can be a bit floodlighty. I think probably it's fair to say we're coasting around half a million on TikTok, which I hasten to add is all organic growth. We've dabbled in paid for marketing and amplification, but simply because we're a startup and in those first 3 years, we haven't had the budget to really move the dial. We know what works, we know what doesn't. We use it almost as a method to hold a loudspeaker up to our community as much as anything else. What do you like? What don't you like? Just get a quick finger in the air. But in terms of our growth, it's been through people liking it and sharing it. And I think that's one of the things we're all so proud of. I cannot wait to light a fire under it with paid for techniques, don't get me wrong, but I think we're all as well open to being surprised by what our followers will tolerate from us. You know, this is not going to be a case of just shoving paid for behind those stories that are going gangbusters in the first 24 hours, because 2 days later they're completely irrelevant. So we've got to move quickly and be really inventive with the tools in the box when it comes to social marketing, performance marketing, I'd call it.
It's fascinating. And in terms of, and I guess, you know, kind of the other thing I'm sort of really interested in is how you, what metrics you use. You know, obviously, you've got a business to run, right? So there's a whole set of business metrics. But like from a kind of news kind of engagement kind of perspective, what's in the sort of the metrics kind of side of things?
I mean, look, it's a lot of the basics in terms of follow account, likes, etc. I think as we grow, well, I mean, I know as we grow, we're actually starting to look at a movement metric working title, which is essentially going to be those ingredients and levers that we want to pull for a single story. And I think crucially to your point on editorial, bringing journalists into that as well, so that they know exactly what the point of their story is going to be. Is it to get likes? Is it to grow a conversation in the comments? Is it to create real world action? I think back to a very early story we did around pap smears, encouraging in the UK, mm-hmm. encouraging young women to get their pap smear as a result of a letter one of our journalists actually received herself from the NHS, and it drove sign-ups at the NHS up by 20% as a result. And that kind of real world action for us feels like a really potent area to experiment in. So in summary, it depends on the story.
Yeah.
And for us, and it depends, you know, on the brand side, it depends on the client. We could have McDonald's coming to us wanting to run a story, but the metric won't be about selling burgers. It will be about people's perception to their sustainability policy, for instance. So I think we need to be a little bit judicious with the kind of figures that we throw out there as we start to grow and, as I say, go really gangbusters on marketing spend.
I love that concept of movement, and I think it's really interesting the way you just framed it. Are you building one? Is it very much kind of a movement across, you know, kind of topics, or do you see sort of micro movements?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and one we debate a lot. I think initially when it was founded, and not to speak for the founders necessarily, but working closely in the founding team since day one, I can say I think you know, the way you initially phrase it of a movement was very much in our mind's eye. However, as time's gone on, and you know, yes, we've listened to our audience, but also observed culture shift even in the last 3 years, it's fair to say that young people and all people, I even put myself in this, identify more with community than global action, and part of that's just driven by human nature, I'm sure. But I think you know, as we look towards 25, our emphasis on building communities of you know, insert understanding, communities of action, communities of, you know, intelligence, who knows what they'll necessarily all look like once we boil them down, is going to be much more important, especially when it comes to establishing our tone of voice from a brand perspective.
What have you learned over that 3-year period? I mean, I'm imagining, yeah, I'm amazed you're even here today with the election, you know,
yes,
a month away or less, right? It must be just, I mean, I'd love to be in that newsroom right now, to
yeah,
be honest, and just see kind of what it's like. But, and I guess things that must be changing so fast, you know, and here you are in New York as well, right?
Yeah.
So, give me a sense of that.
I can speak for myself. Listen, coming to it cold, I would love to give you some big marketing lesson. But actually, the thing that I had never joined up, and I'm not an unintelligent person, but I don't think I'd ever quite joined up the role of preserving journalism in order to safeguard democracy. And I think it's something we all talk about a lot, but in the context of advertising, brands are spending less and less with media because they feel, and that was what our panel was about today, about brand safety. As a result, media is suffering hugely as an industry. And as media slowly, you know, looks down the precipice of, guys, we're going to have to innovate to survive, democracy is threatened because power is not being held to account. And I think what I hadn't, as a proxy to that, really appreciated is the craft of journalism. I've mentioned it a couple of times over the course of this, but the rigor and the structure that needs to be applied in order for journalism to do its job. And for me, that's been a huge eye-opener. Mm-hmm. It's been an eye-opener watching it. It's been frustrating at times to have to deal with when you just want to do a cool creative brand campaign. But it's been exciting and a total education to navigate.
Mm. And I guess to counter that sort of, you know, the plethora of kind of content out there that's being generated,
yes,
that is exactly the opposite to what you just described.
Exactly. And I think that was really, you know, to your earlier point about creating a movement, you know, if there was something overarching all of this, it was about the preservation of democracy through tackling misinformation, through ensuring fact based storytelling in an arena where, frankly, no one was doing it well. And when I say well, it's not just about giving the facts, because of course there are news brands out there giving the facts, but are they doing it in a way that is appealing for the next generation of consumers? I put Gen Z in that, I put Gen Alpha in that. Even in the 3 years, you know, we've been going, there've been people onboarding into a generation who want to be told what's going on in the world in a way that, you know, isn't going to be targeted at you and me. And I think that, for me, has been a huge learning in the last 3 years.
And what insights are you picking up on the consumption and kind of behavioural kind of behaviour of that next generation?
Yeah, I think there is, well, it's twofold. There's definitely a lot of optimism. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, despite the sort of hopelessness of the narrative, certainly in news that I overhear, I'm encouraged by this, you know, I would call it a can-do attitude, which sounds so sort of Enid Blyton, but by the energy that this generation has, you know, whether it's a portfolio career, a side hustle, they sort of come up to with an idea and be like, yeah, I'm going to do that. And the world is available to them in a way that, you know, as I say, I did not grow up with social media. I didn't really grow up with the internet, full stop. So, you know, they just have a window into the world which bears such opportunity. I think as well, I think they suffer, and that sounds so finger pointing, but I think there is a degree of sufferance from culture creating this perception that they are all, you know, hemp wearing activists. Mm-hmm. And actually that's not the case, and that's okay. You know, a lot of them would like to shop with brands that do better for the world. A lot of them want to live lives that contribute more sustainably, but on the flip side they find it really expensive and they can only afford so much, so a lot of them aren't able to do it. Also, okay, that is a reality. So there are a lot of paradoxes that exist and kind of pushes and pulls within that kind of generation that that I think we rub up against, not only as sort of storytellers, but also as employers, and how we function as an employer brand at the news movement.
Really interesting. And, you know, over the period you've been running, you know, you've also had another kind of dynamic sort of, you know, kind of disruptor slash transformer in the form of AI.
Yes.
So tell me about kind of how you've kind of been growing and scaling a business with AI coming in from the sidelines.
Yes, it's hard, isn't it? Because I talk about journalism as an art, and obviously the nature of that suggests that obviously people need to feature within that, and indeed they do. However, there are safety nets and ways that AI can function, and actually one of the co-founders and our head of product, Dion Bailey, has led the charge on innovating AI in the newsroom through his many years at Dow Jones, and alongside Rama Beheshti, our CEO, who was CTO at Dow Jones as well. We have two amazing brains who are able to motivate a great product team to help support the newsrooms. I'll give you an example. I shan't bore you with all the different tools that we've created over the time, but I love this story because it came from a young creator who actually works in our product team, who was playing around with an AI piece of code and unlocked a way for him to track and pick up pockets of conversation that were happening and starting to gain pickup online. Now, don't get me wrong, it's that algorithm needs to be trained. So originally it was, you know, delivering a lot of sports results or, you know, a lot of stuff that we wouldn't necessarily cover. However, it did start to, through training, unlock and identify stories before they happened. Particularly in modern culture, where you can imagine a Taylor Swift gig happens one night. I don't know, I'm making it up, but she trips over. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing that you would be able to pick up that obviously you wouldn't through a simple proactive search with your own eyes. And deliver that to the newsroom in the speed of light time. obviously it then needs eyes to disseminate and decipher what is news and what isn't. But as time has gone on, we call it Top Story Turtle. This little guy has been able to identify some pretty strong lines for us, and the journalists come to comfortably rely on it. As I say, it's another tool in their toolbox. It's not to take away a job from a human, but it's to make the human's job easier.
And I love that, because then you can start to kind of lock into an emerging sort of, you know, piece of content, news, but then you can then look at, see how you can then extend that into a movement in its own right, the pap smear example being one, right?
Correct. And also, when you think about how you take that to brands, it becomes really exciting. We're sitting here at Advertising Week next to the Roundel section, but, you know, think about a brand like Target. Huge amount of categories that it covers. Imagine Target waking up to each morning a report that identifies how each of its categories are being talked about, stories emerging, and the press office can then evaluate them, the social team can evaluate them, and marketing, all to combine and say, oh, this is something worth jumping on, or crikey, I think we've got like a bit of a customer issue over here. Or you can start to see all the multifarious ways that this can aid business and creativity. And I think that's where it starts to get really fertile in terms of our relationship with brands.
Lottie, been an absolute pleasure. Top Story Turtle's going to stay with me for the rest of my life.
Excellent. Good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Business of Marketing podcast is brought to you by Demand Exchange. Demand Exchange provides the technology, content, and expertise to identify and acquire your next ideal customer.